Duncan Wall won a Fulbright scholarship to run away with the circus, and he's never looked back. I'm Lindsay Moon, in for Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, I'll talk with Duncan about the history of the circus, how he first flew trapeze without a safety harness, and about why he's starting a movement to empower circus as an art form, much like ballet or theater. I'll also talk with him about how Bloomington, Illinois plays an important role in the development of modern circus in the U.S. He's author of the new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. Do you have fond memories of clowns, jugglers, and a ringmaster with a red riding jacket? Post them to our Facebook page and enter to win a copy of the book. Join me for a conversation with Duncan Wall on Focus, coming up after this news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, sitting in for Jim Meadows. And today on the show, I'm talking with Duncan Wall. He's author of the new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. He teaches circus history and criticism at Canada's National Circus School and studied the circus art at the National Center for Circus Arts in France. His new book is part history lesson and part memoir. Duncan Wall, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Before I get started, I want to let our listeners know that this is a pre-recorded episode of Focus, so we aren't taking calls this hour, but we still want to hear from you. Find the show on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580 or post in the comment section on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. So, Duncan, I think when most people think about the circus, we think Barnum and Bailey's with a ringmaster clad in riding boots with a red jacket, but that's not exactly how you describe the circus in your book.
Yeah, I mean, that is a type of circus that exists. I think what I discovered when I first discovered the circus, and the book kind of tells that story as well, is that it's only a type of circus, that there are actually many other types of circus that are more potentially contemporary, potentially more creative, and that don't necessarily correspond to those particular cliches in our head.
What is circus, then?
What is circus? It's funny, because circus is in this period right now where there's a lot of debate about the art form. It's actually, you know, traditionally we talk about traditional circus and contemporary circus or modern circus, and you know, that's not unique to circus. In almost every art form, there's the notion of the traditional versus the contemporary. In dance, for instance, there's modern dance, and then there's kind of classical dance, which is ballet. In poetry, there's things like iambic pentameter, right, where you kind of adhere to certain codes, and then there's a more contemporary form of poetry, which is easy and more looser and more open. Circus went through that same shift in the 70s, and now basically, you know, people are trying to figure out what it means to do circus. The question, what is circus, is actually kind of a loaded question. There are those who say that a circus has to be held in a ring, for instance, that it has to include, you know, physical performance, including clowning, including acrobatics, including wire walking, that there's specific types of circus art that you have to include. Other people are more open. They say it can be a kind of combinatory act, art. So any kind of theater that involves like lots of different types of physical performance or lots of different types of any kind of virtuosic act could be a circus. I think I tend to fall more into the latter camp.
This also might be a loaded question from some of the descriptions you give in the book, but with that, are we talking about something like Cirque du Soleil?
Yeah, Cirque du Soleil. I mean, it's funny because I have this conversation with a lot of people, and I've had it a lot over the last month as the book has come out, and like the best thing in terms of introducing people to new circus is just to show it to them, right? It's like to put a bunch of videos online and show them the clips. And that's what I do when I sort of make a new friend, is I sit them down. Because, of course, it's this awkward thing, right, when you explain that you're from the circus. And you're like, oh, so would you, you know, do we train elephants? And I'm like, actually, no. In fact, it's a little more like dance and theater. Like, here, come over, sit next to me, and we'll watch some clips and start to understand. So Cirque du Soleil is a good starting point. Like, it's a good place to say, you know, that's a type of circus that doesn't correspond to, you know, the cliches you mentioned earlier, but it's certainly not the most progressive circus. I mean, Cirque du Soleil is over 25 years old now. You know, it's been around, they've kind of dominated the world, and they're doing their thing. So it's sort of like a gateway drug.
If we're talking about circus as more of an art form, you know, you made some comparisons between ballet. So we can talk about Russian ballet, American ballet. Can you make those same kinds of parallels when you talk about circus art?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was funny. There's a book that came out last year called Apollo's Angels a year, last year, 2 years ago, and it was about the history of ballet. And she, and it was sort of the first big cultural history. It was like a New York Times notable book for the year. And she goes through and she describes the evolutions of ballet almost culturally, like you're saying, like she'll spend a chapter exploring Russian ballet. And I read it, and then the whole time I was thinking, oh my gosh, like this is absolutely, I mean, this is, you could do this exact same book about circus. Like you could do, you know, a lot of the comments that she makes about ballet in those given countries is also true of circus in those countries, which is kind of fascinating. So for instance, like, take Russian ballet, right? It's known as being kind of virtuosic. It's known as having a certain emotional quality that other forms don't have. Russian circus is kind of the same way. It's really virtuosic. It's really technically really proficient. Some of the best acrobats you'll see are Russians. They tend to be kind of like, emotional in that kind of classic, passionate Russian way without necessarily always transferring those motions into creativity. So a French circus, for instance, might be more abstract and also kind of emotional, but also more creative in the way of the French.
Are there markers of American circus?
Absolutely. I mean, America's hard. It's you know, this is something that, so I organized a series of events last month called Circus Now, which is basically to demonstrate contemporary circus around the country. And part of what we observed about American circus is there's a lot that's happening, right? And we wanted to show that off to audiences. But one of the things I observed, too, was that as far as performance goes, there's also a kind of attachment to the past in America that you don't see in other countries as much. It's you know, I talk about a bit about it in the book, but it's largely because the American circus was so popular. To give a kind of context, like when in the 19th century, when a circus star would travel from America to Europe, his name would be written up in the newspaper, you know, the way as if he were like a general or a famous politician. If a circus star got hurt, you know, Mae Worth, who could do this amazing backflip on a horse, she got hurt once, and it was front page news in the New York Times. I mean, the circus was a cultural institution that was beyond anything that we have today as far as live performance goes. It was really more like Hollywood. It was more like professional sports. You know, like it was the NBA and Warner Brothers combined. That kind of power, though, was amazing in terms of the circus then, but it also left a kind of cultural legacy, which is hard to shed, right? The type of circus that happened to be popular during that period and then kind of changed and came to evolve over the course of the 20th century as the circus declined kind of got stuck in our heads. So a lot of what, you know, contemporary artists are facing and a lot of what we as an organization are facing in Circus Now, which is this community building and advocacy organization that I'm running, is trying to shed some of those cliches in favor of a broader definition of circus and, you know, a more modern, more exciting definition.
You kind of talk about circus like there was a glory era.
Yeah.
When did that end, and why do you think it's been so hard to shed that ideal in the U.S.?
They talk about the kind of golden age, the quote American golden age, being between 1870 and like 1904. Or even as far up to the First World War. What they mean by that generally is what historians mean is that was the time when the most circuses were touring and when the shows were the biggest and the most kind of culturally relevant. As what happened basically sort of in brief is that, you know, cinema arrives in the early 20th century, things like radio then arrive, television arrives, and the idea of going to see a circus, especially going to see a circus in a tent with like 14,000 other people, full of acts that are kind of far away and acts that are maybe hard to distinguish, becomes less attractive to people. You know, seeing an elephant live is, of course, impressive, but seeing it, you know, live from 200 feet is less impressive, and maybe less impressive certainly than seeing it on a big screen, you know, where you can actually sort of ride the elephant yourself, so to speak.
Right.
So the 20th century circus declined, again, because of that, because of the challenges, economic and cultural challenges. And then I guess to answer your question, though, why did it stick in the mind so much? And it might be because the circus life itself was so fascinating to people. That when we talk about circus as a performance form, you know, it was maybe couldn't compete with cinema. When you think about circus as a way of living, or like a kind of this magical world and the magical connotations that it always had, that remained ever powerful. So over the course of the 20th century, when you had less interest in the circus, there were still books that came out every year. When circus shows were folding, there were still books coming out every year and TV shows being made about circus life and movies coming out about circus life. The problem was that it was kind of representing a circus life that didn't correspond to reality anymore.
I want to talk with you a little bit about your experience doing circus. You know, we commonly think of people I guess now running away to join the circus, and it's kind of a joke. But when you were studying circus in France, that's not how people perceived it there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'd be interesting. So why do you call it a joke? In what sense was it a joke?
Maybe I heard this in a movie, but for example, so and so couldn't get into college, and so now they're going to clown school. You hear people talk about that, but that's really the exact opposite of how you describe going to circus school in the ordinary acrobat.
Yeah, and then like one of the things about the quote running away to the circus was that it became this kind of like metaphor for going and doing something crazy, right? So I mean, it was a bit of a joke, but it was also a bit of what you're describing, which is this extreme, you know, decision to run away with the circus and
right.
leave everything behind.
Exactly.
And that my, you know, the kind of what you're alluding to is the fact that in France, and I'd say all around the world right now, to go do the circus, you don't need to run away, period. Like, you can do it in your backyard by juggling. You can do it on a Tuesday night by finding an aerial class or finding an acrobatics class. And the kind of circus you're practicing or the kind of life you're living when you do that is not nearly as extreme as it was before. So, you know, I have friends who are ad executives, and they do the job from, you know, they live in New York, so they're working from like 8 a.m. to like 7 p.m., but they have these long days, and then they check out at night, and they go do aerial work, which is, you know, it's either trapeze or it's working on a tissue, a big fabric that hangs from the ceiling, and they do it because it's physical, right? And it's like something, it's almost like going to the gym for them, and it's creative because they're making up new moves, and they get to feel beautiful doing it, and there's a community to it. So it's really not that different than like going to, you know, like from friends who get big into yoga or friends who get big into, you know, who go play softball at night. Circus is kind of approaching that level of cultural integration.
I also think it's interesting when you talk about circus education. I was really surprised to read in the book the extent to which there are governments in Europe that support circus schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a larger conversation about the role of government in art, right? Like in the States, we don't. Certainly, governments give subsidies to art schools. Like I'm sure Juilliard is entirely or in large part funded by the government, but we really don't have anything like a kind of national conservatories the way they do in Canada or England or France. And so, you know, over there, the idea the idea of having a national theater school in America seems kind of odd to us. In France, that's not odd at all. And the same way, it's not odd for them to have a kind of national circus school or I think they have a national marionette academy, a national puppetry academy. And all that means basically is it's the kind of state-sponsored hub for education in that discipline. And I mean, I guess what I would note too is it's interesting is it's funny. And, you know, when I first heard about it and I narrate the scene in the book, and the book is really it's me being drawn into this world, right? It's me being a guy who goes away to college, who sees a circus show, who thinks it's pretty cool, and then gets sucked into it, sucked into the life. And then that's that woven with history. You know, so when I discovered the National Circus School, I was like, wow, that's crazy. Like, you know, the idea that the government would pay for circus. But I think it's even crazier. And what I've come to discover is that that's not an old thing. Like, it's not like some weird institution that the French had in the 20s and just kind of stuck around. They actually didn't create it until the 80s as part of this new circus movement. And then on top of that, that it's like a movement that is spreading. So you're seeing more and more countries to this day, creating national circus schools.
If someone wants to learn about trapeze or acrobatics and they want to do that in the U.S., where do you go to learn about circus? Or where do you go to learn these art forms?
Well, I would suggest, I mean, I don't know if this is self-promotion, but this Circus Now, the organization I mentioned, is a good place to start, circusnow.org. There's, you know, shoot us an email and we can link you up with people. The American Youth Circus Organization is also a wonderful national organization that has a database of places where especially young people can learn about circus. But really what I would just do is Google. Like if you're living, you know, and you'd be shocked at the size of cities that have circus, you know, circus activity. You know, it's not just in Illinois. It's not just Chicago. It's Bloomington. It's Urbana, Champaign, Urbana. Like, there are circus schools all over. And so, yeah, I would Google, you know, the name of your town, and then I would Google something like circus school, or I would Google acrobatics or juggling or whatever it is that might interest you. And odds are there's some other people who are interested in it and have set up some small structure.
I also wanted to ask you, you describe how difficult it is to get into some of these circus schools in parts of the world.
Yeah.
And I think the program you went to, you described as being having an acceptance rate lower than what it is at Harvard in the U.S.
That's right, yeah.
When you were there and you came on and started the program as a novice, didn't know a whole lot, how did the other performers respond to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's this whole, my initial draft of the book was full of my, a lot of my insecurity and anxiousness about being this total horrible physical person.
Right.
And then that was cut out because it's just not that interesting. But to be clear, I got the Fulbright Fellowship, which is a national government fellowship that allows you to go to another country and study a subject. And as part of that fellowship, we arranged a deal with the National Circus School of France, wherein I would enroll in a prep program. And to understand what that is, you have to understand a bit of the kind of pyramid that exists. So there are youth programs, kind of amateur schools, and then there's something called preparatory programs or pre-professional programs. And that's basically it's like any kind of prep school in Europe or I guess in America, it'd be like your kind of your senior year of high school. And so it's a year to basically get you ready to go to the main school, which is the professional school. So I was enrolled in the prep year of the national school program. So the people in my class were not students who had passed that entrance exam. They weren't into Harvard, but they were other students who wanted to go to Harvard, so to speak, who wanted to go to the national school. And one of them actually did end up going at the end of the year. And what's funny about that is even having said that, even though they hadn't passed the admissions test, these were still kids who had done circus since they were five or six. So think of getting in a room with somebody who's played violin from the age of five when you're 23, which I was at the time, or somebody who's played soccer since that age, and it was still completely intimidating. They quite knew what I was doing there. They thought they kind of got a kick out of me. I became a bit like a mascot, right, because they're doing round off backflips and I'm working on my cartwheel in the corner, they knew that I was passionate about circus. They knew that I was doing a lot of research into circus. And so I think they were generally pretty supportive at that point too. And this was in 2003 that I originally had the experience. There weren't really that many Americans knocking around the European circus. So for them, it was just kind of neat to see, I think, somebody from North America. At that point, Montreal had taken off where Cirque du Soleil is, but somebody from America specifically who was interested in this new form.
When you first arrived at the school, there's this really, it's really interesting to listen to you talk about, you all lined up and they had you do somersaults.
Right, right.
Can you recount what you describe in the book?
Yeah, basically as part of the initial entrance exam, it's not an entrance exam, it was an exam to kind of figure out where we are so that over the course of the year we can then track our progress, right? And this is the first day. And I didn't know anybody who went to circus school. I had a brief conversation, which I recount in the book, that kind of sent me on this journey. But I didn't know anybody personally who could tell me what happened at circus school. And so I arrived and we get there. And at that point, too, I had no idea that these other students were already so trained. I assumed they were kind of like me, just people who, were kind of curious about the circus and wanted to learn some skills. And so as part of that test, what they do is they walk you through from the most basic moves, so like a somersault or a cartwheel, all the way through a kind of, back handspring, backflip, even double backflip. And move one was the somersault, and I'm kind of waiting there in line, waiting for my turn. And these other students start to pound through the somersault, and it was as if the Romanian national gymnastics team had walked in the door. They were sort of arcing through the air and sort of diving perfectly and spinning and popping up. And it was this perfect display of physical prowess, even though it was a somersault. And that was when I first, I think, realized that I was a bit in over my head. I hadn't done, in my kind of just exuberance to get there, I hadn't thought to, do a practice of any somersaults or cartwheels. Though, you think one might want to do that.
Right.
It didn't occur to me to try to work on my handstand.
And you mentioned when you were at the beginning of that you didn't really know who to talk to about what happens in circus school. I think everyone thinks that. So what do you do there? Now that you teach the circus school, what types of programs or curriculum do students expect?
Yeah, it really depends on the school. So each kind of, as we talked about earlier, each culture having its own circus, kind of circus. The same is true for circus education. Generally, though, it's a combination of circus arts. So it'll be, you know, training in, and the basics is acrobatics. So everybody learns acrobatics, and that's, you know, gymnastics, basically. And then you will often train in specific circus arts. So if you're interested in juggling, you'll, you know, learn how to juggle. If you're interested in wire walking, you'll learn how to wire, walk in a wire. And complementary to that, and this is actually what makes the circus, I think, so cool today, and part of what is really catching on and making it an activity that a lot of people are excited about, is the fact that because the new circus, the circus that emerged in the 70s, is trying to be creative and trying to be a kind of more diverse art form, the training reflects that. So you don't just do, you know, you're not just learning how to throw a ball in the air or how to do a backflip. You're also studying theater. So literally, you know, my school, they're literally acting classes taught by theater teachers. You're also studying dance. So you're learning classical dance and you're learning modern dance. And the idea is that, you know, we want a performer who is on stage, who can, has a presence, right, who's able to express things, who's able to play a character if called upon. You know, and that, if you think of your kind of old classic circus act, the performer kind of comes on, salutes the audience, does the stunt, and then goes off, generally kind of as themselves, right, or a modified version of themselves. Whereas in a contemporary circus, you could be, you know, you could be called upon to be, I don't know, Einstein. And now you're Einstein, and you have to beat Einstein the way you would in a theater play. But you're also, you know, there are circus skills you have to perform. And that's kind of in Montreal where I teach. There's also, you know, classes in philosophy. There's also classes in literature. I'm kind of responsible for something like the circus history / theory / analysis / what's happening in the modern circus world curriculum. And the idea is really to be developing not just the person's body, but also their mind. And that's, you know, kind of rooted in the philosophy that if you're going to be an artist, you can't just be a gymnast, right? You can't just be somebody who knows how to do a backflip. You have to be somebody who knows how to think about the world and about yourself, and then hopefully translate that thinking into some kind of expression for an audience.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and you're listening to Focus. We'll be back with Duncan Wall, author of the new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present, right after this short break. Thanks for joining us today on Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, in for Jim Meadows. We're talking this hour with Duncan Wall, author of the new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. So before the break, we were talking about circus education, and you were telling me a little bit about the curriculum that students expect at circus schools, and you teach circus history, so I do want to talk a little bit about the history of the circus.
Cool.
When was the first circus?
Oh, another loaded question. I mean, nothing in the circus is simple. This is the story of my life at this point. It's generally, people distinguish between the circus arts and circus kind of proper. The circus arts, which are the arts that we generally associate with the circus, clowning, wire walking, juggling, trapeze, etc. Those, with the exception of trapeze, which actually originated in the 19th century, those go back kind of time immemorial. So, you know, there were there are drawings on, or the kind of cake drawings / carvings on Egyptian tombs of jugglers. In the Chinese record, there are acrobats that go back to 3000 BC. And it really is kind of, you know, some people say that acrobatics was actually the oldest art form, that it was around before dance even, and that it originated in the shaman, you know, who were dancing around the fire or who were moving around the fire trying to enact the animal spirits, right? So if you wanted to be a monkey, you might sort of learn to tumble on your hands in order to enact the spirit of that monkey. That all kind of continued. It became a form of performance in the classical era, kind of Roman Greece. And then all the way through the Middle Ages, there were kind of traveling performers. The circus itself, though, or what we think of when we think of the circus, didn't get codified until 1768, and that was in England, when a particular equestrian master, a kind of old cavalry guy named Philip Astley, came to London and decided to create a show that combined horses, so horses running around in a ring, right, with equestrian feats, mm-hmm. and then the kind of acts I was describing before. So your acrobatics and your juggling, your tumbling.
That continued to evolve over time.
Yeah, and that was really just the beginning. So it didn't evolve actually. So Astley created the circus in 1768, and then, you know, he kind of exported it throughout Europe, and it caught on like wildfire as a form, because at that point, you know, you have to remember that people had horses. And so, you know, there were no cars, obviously, but the horse wasn't just a type of transportation. It was also, you know, the way you did work, right? The way you went to war. Horses were completely integrated in the human society. Astley then creates this form that has horses in it, and then people go and they watch people doing things on horses that they can't do themselves with all these other stunts. And so it takes off all over the world. It evolved. It evolved in the sense that each kind of culture created its own version. But what's also fascinating about that type of circus is it's really not that far from the kind of circus we think about when we have that kind of cliched idea of the circus. So, you know, even when you kind of think of a circus, what are the first things that come to mind for you?
Oh, the ringmaster and the lions, probably.
Right, ringa. So
Cotton Candy
you know,
Peanuts,
Astley
too.
Created the position of the ringmaster when he was like 37 years old, supposedly, mythically, as a way for him to stay involved with the circus, right, because he was then too old to perform. The ringmaster outfit, is there a ringmaster outfit that you think of?
Riding boots and a red jacket. Was that him also?
That was, yeah. I mean, the riding boots are from his kind of the equestrian, right, the equestrian cavalry act. And the red jacket is actually the English cavalry. So, you know, when we think of it, which is red, there's in the whole the famous, the red coats are coming, the red coats are coming. And, you know, even the kind of classic circus tent, are there colors that you associate with a circus tent?
Red and white.
Red and white, or, yeah, red and white, or red and yellow.
Right.
Right, which were actually the red and gold of the British cavalry, too. So it's really, and it goes, I mean, to the extent, and it's kind of, this is one of the most remarkable things I found, is to the extent that, like, when you went to a circus at Philip Astley's theater in 1780 or wherever, the ring itself was 13 meters in diameter, right? And that was the kind of the size of the ring that he'd found to be the most efficient for horseback acrobatics, because it would keep, you know, imagine a guy standing on the back of a horse, it would press his feet into the horse without, so it had enough centripetal force to press his feet into the horse without being so much that kind of pulls him outward. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he kind of devised that formula. Nobody knew if it was correct, but that's what he said. If you went to any other circus all over the world, right, for the next 200 years, almost without exception, they had the same size ring, right? It was a 13 meters in diameter. Like, that's how codified the circus was for almost 200 years until 1968. Of course, there were different types of circus. So like in Paris, as we were talking about, there was a kind of aristocratic circus where, you know, the Duke and the Prince and everybody else would go to the circus on Thursday night the way they would go to the ballet on Wednesday night. And there'd be these beautiful ballerinas and tutus kind of doing pretty things on the horses. And there'd be clowns who made intellectual jokes. But even there, the ring was the same size and the acts were more or less the same.
When you set out to study circus history, there hadn't been a lot done. There was a train station ticket salesman that plays a role in this story.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'd never written a book before. Like, I didn't know what it was to write a history book. You know, like I started, and I don't consider myself a historian still. I'm a journalist slash guy who went away and did this thing and felt the need to tell the story. there are people who are super passionate about circus history, but because the art form was so generally maligned by society, because it was seen as this kind of low art form that maybe even was against intellectual development, maybe even like hurt intellectual development, there wasn't, you know, any kind of academic study of it. So there are, for instance, there's no full-time circus historian in any university all over America. And that's, you know, kind of shocking when you think about the fact that most universities, including many in Illinois, have theater and dance departments, and yet not one even studies, you know, has a full historian on staff.
Right.
So as a result, you know, people who are passionate about the circus have had to find other ways to make a living. And in Illinois, you guys are really lucky enough to have the, at ISU, Illinois State University, there's a wonderful library with a circus history collection. And one of the folks who's associated with that library is named Steve Gossard, and he wrote the kind of definitive trapeze history. Steve was not a librarian or even worked at the university, though. He worked at the train station in Bloomington. If I could say, too, another fascinating Illinois fact, which I love about, is that, you know, Bloomington today is considered, it has one of the best collections of circus memorabilia and circus literature in America. And if you ask why that is, right, Steve told me that it's because, you know, during the late 19th century, when trapeze kind of started taking off, you needed to have a big building, right, to do trapeze in, and
right.
You needed to have a place for people to fall. And at that point, nets weren't really common, right? So a lot of what they did was they would find these giant old milling houses that are full of sawdust, and they would set the trapeze up in the milling barns, or whatever you want to call them, and then fly above and fall into the sawdust. And Bloomington was a milling capital, as so was Saginaw, Michigan. And so those two cities became kind of trapeze capitals of America for almost 50 years.
Speaking of trapeze, you described the first time you flew trapeze in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, and it's funny because I feel like trapeze is this funny thing where it's still this thing that people think of as being mythical. And I'm to the point where I think of it like a workout, you know, like at this point in my life. Like, I know so many trapezes and I've done it so much that it sort of feels like, I'm just going to go do some trapeze. But I you know, every time I talk about it with somebody, including my mother, you know, who is not at all connected to it, it's like, oh gosh, trapeze.
Right.
and so I kind of had that idea too in the beginning. And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this is going to be crazy. And I got there and it was crazy insofar as, and this was back, you know, the first chapter of the book is basically about how I discovered the circus. And I see a show and I'm kind of enamored with this new style circus. And so I start going to more shows. And then I see an advertisement for a trapeze workshop. And again, I had no connection to trapeze. I didn't know what it was. I had that kind of mythical thing in my head, too. I went to the workshop, and somehow in the conversation of my French was very bad to begin with, but in conversing with the people at the workshop, they kind of understood that I had done trapeze already. And so when it came my turn to go up and fly off the thing, they didn't put the kind of the life belt, it's called, but the kind of harnesses. And so basically when you do trapeze, you have these ropes that connect you through a belt in order to, you know, to keep you safe for the first, you know, whatever month. And so they didn't put that on there. And so when I swang, I was kind of swinging free. And it was funny because I don't think I realized quite, I had seen the other people go with the trapeze, with the belt, like I'd seen them go with the harness. But as soon as I jumped off, it like struck me for the first time that I didn't have that. And, you know, I basically had a stroke. Like, I just stopped moving, and my body went, you know, I'm a literal figure of a stroke. Like, I just sort of went limp on the thing and hung there like this dead fish. And very quickly, the people, you know, who were running the workshop realized what was going on, so they just were just like, just stop moving, just don't, just stay there, just don't do anything. And so I swung until I kind of came to a stop, and then I dropped into the net. And at no point was I in any danger. Like, the net was beneath me. There was all sorts of people around supporting me. But it was absolutely terrifying. And I think because of that idea that I had of the trapeze in my head, like, I had this sense of it being something big and grand, you know, and kind of spectacularly dangerous, which, of course, it isn't. And I should mention, too, that just for any listener out there who might be tempted to do the trapeze, that never happens in America, because we have very different tort law and very different liability, and somebody would sue you to pieces if you did that. Whereas in France, they're a little more laid back with that stuff.
Right. And that was the first time you'd flown on the trapeze, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the very first time. Yeah.
Was it difficult to do it a second time?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, as I say in the book, it was kind of that experience that launched me into going to circus school and into doing the Fulbright. So it was like, you know, in a way, it was like, I was like, oh, that was so scary. But I was also like, I want to do it again, or I want to, you know, I want to explore this world more. But I felt a kind of exhilaration that I hadn't felt in a while, and didn't even know I could feel on like a Saturday afternoon.
I did want to ask you, when you applied for the Fulbright scholarship, when I think of the Fulbright program, studying circus is not something that I would think would be funded by Fulbright. Was it difficult to write the grant proposal for that?
You know, so just for those who don't know, the Fulbright is you apply with a project. It's usually it's highly competitive, but you apply with a pretty simple project. So it'll be like a couple pages describing what you want to do, and your academic record, and why it's important, and why it's important now. And I remember when I was in this sort of discovering this whole circus world, I got an email that was like, oh, here's this thing called the Fulbright. And I was like, oh, well, wouldn't it be kind of funny to go to circus school on that? Like, if I could find a way to use this to go to circus school. And that's really how it started. It was almost like a joke, oh, that'd be hilarious. Because you're right, you just don't think of, I mean, Fulbright, they study neuroscience and, like, you know, classical composing. They don't study circus. But, you know, I think what worked in my favor and what in the case that I made, which I would still make today, is that the kind of circus that I wanted to study and what was happening in the circus was absolutely valid on a kind of cultural, artistic level. And what I said was that it was kind of this, and again, which has been proven out in the last 10 years for me, is it's this kind of new form of physical theater. It's a new form of physical practice. It's a new way of bringing people together. It's this revolution in this art form that goes back thousands and thousands of years, and that there's a lot to be learned from the study of it as an art form, and also a lot to be learned from it, just like doing it. I don't know what kind of conversations happened in the back rooms of the Fulbright Commission.
Right.
I do know that when I got there, they were like excited about me, and they kind of knew me as the circus guy already. The other thing that this is important actually is that I remember I was talking with a professor at the University of Iowa where I did my undergrad about this whole proposal, and he was advising me, and he'd won a couple Fulbrights, and the year before I made my application, and basically terminating that year, France, the nation of France, had declared 2002 the year of the circus, right? So the government pumped all this more money into it. They gave more money to the national school. They set up festivals around the country. They set up new publications about the circus. There were something like 10 or 12 books about the circus that came out. And I remember at that moment, he said, when we discovered that, he was like, okay, yeah, this can happen. Because clearly here was this indication that it wasn't just some flight of fancy, right? That actually it was this movement that was happening and progressing. And, you know, the government of France had decided to put it at the front of their to-do list, which I think helped.
Do you think that maybe the U.S. has lessons to learn from those places?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, not just France. And, you know, lots of European countries now have vibrant circus scenes and have, professional circus education. In America, it's hard to make art in America. It's hard to make live art, especially. Like, it's hard to make theater, it's hard to make dance, and it's hard to make circus. So what you've seen is, you know, in the 70s, there was a lot of circus, kind of contemporary circus happening in America. And then it wasn't really supported by the government, and it was hard for circus artists to get money, foundational money, because of some of the reputational stuff we talked about before. So they ended up opening schools where they can train amateur students and make a living, or they ended up going to Europe. And a lot of the kind of best, not a lot, but many of the best artists that were around in the 70s went to Europe. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the lessons are in terms of funding for the art form. So I wrote an editorial in the New York Times recently. We're talking about the need for arts organizations to recognize circus as a valid art form and begin funding it as such on a level of dance or theater or like classical music. In terms of structure, like right now what we're trying to do is create some national infrastructure for the circus, so a circus network where artists and educators can be communicating, and just stuff, you know, online stuff where people can be seeing cool circus videos. I mean, I think one of the kind of best metaphor I can make is that when I was a kid, I was a soccer player. Like I played serious soccer. Like every day I'd wake up and I'd, you know, go out in the yard and play soccer and play at recess. And I was on this team that toured all over. And I played it literally every day for almost 10 years. And almost never, I don't think once did I go to a professional soccer game. There just wasn't professional soccer in America back then. And there was no sense of like, I couldn't watch the Premier League in Europe on TV. And so I kind of grew up doing it without connecting to it in an art form. And I think what's happening in America now is that circus is a bit in that situation. Like, we have hundreds and hundreds of circus schools around America, but we don't really see the coolest, newest work because it's not happening here, or it's happening, you know, in isolated places. And so a lot of what, you know, the battle now is to try to just expose people to that work, again, through, you know, something as simple as an online YouTube video or, you know, a festival, ultimately, or, you know, promotion for companies that are doing that work. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned from other countries.
In writing this book, did you have an agenda? Were there misconceptions that you wanted to correct, or were you just really interested in the circus and wanted to share your experience? Or was it a combination of those things?
I think it was both. Yeah, I mean, I think it was that it's hard to call it an agenda only because I didn't go in with any kind of, it wasn't an issue that I was necessarily attached to from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I came from some progressive circus family and felt like I needed to justify my worth, right? It was more that I went to France and I discovered this thing that I had never seen before and never even heard about. And by thing, I mean this whole artistic movement, and then felt like, know, how could I go and spend this year doing this and meet all these amazing people and have all these amazing experiences without sharing it, and without trying to convey to the people that I knew, in, especially in like the theater and dance world and people who like art, that there's this other kind of live performance that's really, really cool. So, you know, when I then sat down to write the book, and it, you know, it was a long process, and I ended up getting way more to the history actually during the writing period. I didn't necessarily even care about the cliches that existed. You know, like, it wasn't like I was trying to fight those cliches. It was more like I was trying to say, look, like, this exists. Like, this is here too. You know, I don't know how you feel about that kind of old circus form. I never really cared much about it. And I actually care way more about it now than I did back then through the historical research and stuff. But what I did care about was this new form of theater, like this new form of physical performance that they call contemporary circus, and that I wanted to share.
When you describe when you first got into circus and started to appreciate it, it was, you described in the book as kind of this enveloping, all-consuming feeling. And I have to admit, while I was reading the book, I had one of those literary moments when I looked up and it was 4 hours later and I was 100 pages into the book and hadn't even realized what time it was.
That is the nicest compliment you can give a writer. For the record, please tell all of your, every writer you ever meet that, because that's the best. Thank you.
You're welcome. Would you read from the book for us?
Sure, yeah. I actually wanted to share a passage about, that does a bit of what I'm describing here, that talks about the relationship between the new circus and the old circus, and that, you know, as much as we're talking about how the circus has changed and how it's opened up and how kind of progressive and creative it is, there are also elements of it that I think and I would defend pretty strongly that connect to the old world, and that some of the richness of being in the circus and being enveloped by it, like you say, comes from those values. So this is actually, I'm visiting a company in France called Les Arceaux, the Arts Sautes, which is basically means the jumping arts, and it's a company that does just trapeze. So they stage a show in a trapeze in a giant tent, wherein the audience sits in these almost like hammock-like seats, and they fly above you. It's about an hour and a half long show. It's operatic music, white costumes. It's very kind of smart and refined. And again, it's all trapeze. And so in visiting them too, I was kind of struck by what's known as the backyard, which is the area around the circus tent, where everybody stays and where they live. And this is my first exposure to that in the contemporary world. And I describe, just for the record too, I describe some of these old back lots or backyards, and then I say, I thought of these old circuses on my visit to Les Arceaux. I had never seen a proper backyard. I'd even come to wonder whether they still existed. Touring without a tent is 30% cheaper and logistically simpler, without worries of lights, heating, housing, and food. The troops that continue to use tents are often small, and so their lots have a different feel, more like that of a family on vacation. Even Cirque du Soleil, a tenting operation that takes 7 days to set up a lot and 3 to dismantle it, fails to evoke the old wonder. The performers fly in on airplanes and sleep in high-priced hotels. The troupe's village is organized and secure. Yet something about the atmosphere at Les Arceaux that night recaptured a lost world for me. Exiting from the cookhouse, I found the lot buzzing. The sun had set completely. A set of floodlights illuminated the bulbous tent from below, causing it to glow ethereally. The parking lot was full. Groups of people drifted around the tent, down the line of trailers toward the dark forest. The lot felt like the genuine article, like the lots I had read about. I wandered among the trailers. There were at least 30 of them, of various shapes and sizes. They reminded me of the wagons in the old photos and films. I could see into their windows, which glowed with shadow plays of domesticity. A woman feeding a child with a spoon, a sturdy man hunched on his elbows over a newspaper. There was nothing extraordinary about the scene. It was what I had expected in many ways, but I was moved. The tent had a lot to do with my response. Although many modern companies tour in theaters, a tent evokes the mythic circus, the mystery and romance of swooping into one town after another, assembling a world and then tearing it down. But it wasn't just the tent. The circus has changed. Elephants and freaks no longer hold the same attraction. But what I felt in the lot that night was that some essential part of the old culture remained. I felt I was observing people outside the mainstream. there were echoes of the old values. It was an elemental life. These were traveling people who had chosen to work with their bodies and in relation to nature, and they were a family.
That's very moving how you describe the people that are a part of the circus. You spend a lot of time, and I assume have made a lot of friends with people that are in the circus. Who are the people that you describe? Tell me more about the types of people that are in the circus.
I mean, it is still pretty divided in terms of the contemporary circus person versus the traditional circus person. There are still, you know, traditional circus performers who come from seven generations of families, you know, families that goes back seven generations, who grew up doing the circus the way somebody would grow up doing carpentry hundreds of years ago. In terms of the contemporary circus, well, I think the circus is in this neat period where people can still get jobs doing it, right? You can still pretty easily be a professional circus performer. I mean, the school where I teach has a job placement rate of 95%. So the students come out, and they usually travel internationally, right? So they have a kind of world, global awareness that I associate with the circus. They're fit as all get out, right? They're the most fit people you'll ever see in your life. Sometimes it's sort of discouraging for me to be around so many fit people because they're, you know, a circus strength is kind of like it's not like bodybuilding, right? It's like being able to, it's almost like a gymnast, right? You're strong and you're flexible. And you have muscular endurance, and you're kind of, you can lift the biggest thing. They tend to have a kind of connection to nature, and that doesn't necessarily. And it's funny because I don't know that necessarily has to do with circus today. Like circuses happen in theater, in kind of progressive settings like Cirque du Soleil. But in the art form itself, there's still this idea of a connection to the environment, of being kind of true to the resources that you're using to create your shows. There's a little bit of I think it comes from maybe the internationalism as well. I don't want to say hippiness, but a kind of almost like an the way anthropologists dress circus performers and people in the circus community are a bit like that. You know, sort of like a scarf that is a bit more colorful than you'd see on somebody else, or a pair of leather boots that are kind of worn. And they're open. I mean, the thing that has most shocked me about the circus and that has enriched my life in ways that would be hard for me to describe is the sense of community that I found. It's unlike what I experienced. I didn't experience anything like it in theater or even in sports. There's a sense of everybody kind of being together as part of this big family, which is actually why I chose that passage, because it really does feel, you know, and I experienced this actually last month when I was touring around for the book and going to community, from community to community, is in each community, I was kind of welcomed, and I was seen as part of that larger circus family, which, you know, is part of the history of the circus, right? This notion of the people traveling around and it being open and diverse and inclusive, and it's also part of the circus today. Insofar as when you do a circus act with somebody, like if you and I were to go do a hand balancing act, if I were to sort of support you above me on my hands, we would have a different relationship, you know, and we would have a kind of trust that we didn't have before. And that trust then is sort of spun out into the community at large, I think, from individual reactions.
That's interesting that you talk about it that way, especially because from my understanding, it wasn't an easy thing to be a part of circus community. Is that changing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't easy. Like you could, you know, there is this idea of running away with the circus, right? There is this notion that, like, you could, if you wanted to, give up your life and there would be this place that would have you. Or, you know, in the case of even, like, some of the worst elements of the circus in the past, like the freaks, like, this was a place where they could come and be together. What made it hard to get into the circus was before was that it was a largely family-driven operation. So, you know, if you didn't grow up the son of an acrobat and hadn't been doing back handsprings from the age of two, you know, in your father's living room, it might be hard to compete with those people. That's changed now because there's this infrastructure we were talking about earlier. Like, you can send your kid to a circus school the way that you would send them to soccer practice, or the way that you would send them to, you know, like a theater camp. And as the kids grow up, you know, if they want to be professionals, they now have a way to do that and the skills to do that. And even if they don't want to be professionals, they can then have an experience that can include them in the community in a different kind of way, because the community now includes all of those schools, includes all of the kind of, you know, other organizations, which are like social circus organizations, which are using circus for social good, or things like circus therapy. you know, it's one of the themes that we like to hit in the sort of circus world is that it's open. It's the ring is open now. It's an open circus.
We're almost out of time for now, but I did want to talk with you a little bit about clowning and juggling before I let you go.
Sure.
So the idea of a clown with big shoes and a nose and maybe a flower that squirts water was kind of how you entered the first clowning class you went to.
Right.
But that view is much different now.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way, this is why I kind of like talking about clowns and clowning, because it feels like a really strong metaphor for the circus in general, or the kind of the circus, the changes in the circus purified. You know, when I was saying earlier, there were kind of codes that we associate with the circus, cliches. You know, nothing, in no act is that more the case than in clowning, right? Where even if you've never been to a circus, if you say the word clown to somebody, like, they're going to have a very specific, you know, even if they've never been to a circus, they're going to have a very specific reaction, right? They're going to see the red nose, they're going to see the big bee, they're going to see the big wig, they're basically going to see Bozo. As contemporary clowning has developed and changed, those kind of codes, right, have been stripped away. So, you know, many modern clowns now don't have red noses, they don't have big shoes, they don't have weird hair, they might not wear makeup at all, their clothes might fit totally perfectly. Which, you know, brings up the interesting question, like, what is a clown then, right? Like, what, in the same way that, like, earlier I kind of stammered when you asked me what is circus, like, you know, what is a clown is a big and loaded question. One of the things that, you know, clown scholars or thinkers or theorists point to is an idea of vulnerability. So that when you see a clown on stage and he's utterly failing at everything he attempts, he's failing for you, right? He's kind of making himself vulnerable. He's allowing himself to be a failure in order to give you pleasure. And that's something that you find even in contemporary clowning. And part of what makes it so difficult is, like, how do you get up on stage and present yourself in a way that's at once authentic and also creative, but also maintain that notion of failure and of vulnerability. You know, one of the and again, to sort of to make it more concrete, because I know that sounds kind of abstract, like, there are, you know, to think of a clown, like, you might think of somebody like Charlie Chaplin, right? Or like even, you know, Woody Allen, or like Kramer on Seinfeld, right? Like, these are people who have kind of comedic tendencies, who repeat their characters again and again. And, you know, especially in the case of somebody like Chaplin or Kramer, are lovable because they're kind of vulnerable, right? Like, they kind of wear their heart on their sleeve, and you know what they're thinking at all times, and they are at once authentic and surprising. So, you know, that's kind of clowning today, at least as I've come to understand it.
Where does the title of the book come from?
Where does it come? Where the muse? It comes from the muse. I don't know actually how it originated. I do know that it kind of stuck in my head initially. Obviously, insofar as it parallels my experience, right? Like, I am in some ways an ordinary acrobat, right? I was somebody who had no connection to the circus and who came to the circus and discovered it and started doing it. I also think over time, though, kind of came to feel like it represented well the circus today as a whole. That when you say the word acrobat, just alone, that there is this kind of little magnetic pop that happens in your brain, like acrobat, like what is that? It seems exotic and extreme. And so to talk about an ordinary acrobat is to talk about stripping away a bit some of that extremity, right? And saying, no, like, you know, and actually an acrobat is something very specific and real, and that you can be an acrobat. You could start being an acrobat today. And the circus, you know, it's almost like saying the ordinary circus, right? The circus that is everywhere and part of our lives and that we all can experience. So, yeah, I think that's kind of where it came from.
Where can we find your book?
You can find my book at your local independent bookstore, I presume. You can find it online at Amazon. You can go to circusnow.org or look me up on Facebook.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on Focus.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
This hour on Focus, we talked with Duncan Wall. He's author of the new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. You can find out more about his book and the movement Circus Now by visiting our website at will.illinois.edu, where you can also find a free download of today's program and past Focus shows and an excerpt of Duncan's book. You can also connect with the show on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Lindsay Moon. Thanks for joining us.